I'm Marty Moscowen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. Bugs are back as the weather heats up. Many of us cringe at the sight of cockroaches and crickets when they show up. But in this hour of the show, we're going to show some appreciation for the insect world. Today, we'll hear about eating bugs and how it could help solve the world's hunger problem. Our guest, Daniela Martin, wrote a book on the topic. We'll also hear from disgust expert psychologist Paul Rozin. Plus, insects as tuneful musical instruments with David Rothenberg, who incorporates insect sounds into his compositions. But first, gardener Franz Soren and entomologist John Gelhaus on all the good that bugs provide the world. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us today. Today on the show, an homage to the insect world. While many of us consider them gross and refer to them as pests, bugs are an important part of our ecosystem and have other benefits that might go unnoticed. We begin by listening to my conversation with expert gardener Franz Soren, as well as entomologist and Drexel University professor John Gelhaus. They joined us a couple of years ago on the show to tell us why we should thank bugs for all the good they do for our gardens, our food, and the environment. Let's take a listen. So, John Gelhaus, do the bugs need an anti-defamation league, do you think?
They certainly get their share of bad press, and lots of folks are very scared of insects, unfortunately so. As you mentioned, some are ones that we really need to be careful about, but most of them are carrying out their lives and have very little impact to us, or they have a positive impact. And yet we're out with our sprays and fly swatters and the whole bit. And probably we should spend a little more time just kind of watching and observing and seeing what a wonderful world out there they do inhabit.
Well, describe for us a world without insects. I mean, what kind of a world would we live in if we were able to squash and spray all the bugs away?
Well, we'd lose most of our sources of food because most of our fruits and a lot of our vegetables are all pollinated by insects. And without that service from insects, there'd be no fruit set. And so we'd be without a lot of food.
So would the birds be too, right?
And the birds, a lot of the organisms that we care about out there in the world, the birds and frogs and mammals and such that feed on insects, they'd be gone. We'd be certainly awash in falling limbs and timber and the like because insects are great decomposers and break down wood into the soil. They break down leaf litter into the soil and create new soil. So that's something that we'd certainly lose there. We'd lose some of our food products. Honey would no longer be around. We wouldn't have silk anymore. Other things that insects have been used for, shellac, for example, some dyes. We'd lose an important source of information on monitoring our environment. Insects now are used quite a bit, for example, in monitoring water quality routinely by government agencies, but also by volunteer monitors and such. So that would be gone.
Let me ask you one more question before we get Franz Soren in on this conversation. When we think, though, about the world of insects, is it divided into predators and pollinators? Are those the two sort of rough lay categories, or is that a wrong way to think about
insects? Well, probably pollinators, certainly, but there's a lot of insects that are herbivores that feed on plants. And so you maybe could call them a predator on plants in that sense.
Right.
But those are the ones that often get into conflict with us in our gardens, but certainly in agriculture in general. And then a lot of predators. And then there's a tremendous amount that are kind of the decomposers, you know, that feed on the dead plant material and such and break it on down. So.
To you, Franz Soren, and we are getting into the thick of gardening season, which is why I'm in a very good mood. What kind of bugs do we want to attract to our, let's say, vegetable gardens, flower gardens? Help us understand
Ladybugs are wonderful, and I found it very interesting when I got online this morning with iVillage, my community there, and we had a letter from one of our writers saying, oh my God, you know, I've gotten rid of the ladybugs inside my house. Now I'm dealing with bees outside. So we want ladybugs. We want lace wings. We want bees because remember, they are pollinators and we need them. And the majority of them do good in the garden.
And if we just plant our garden, if we plant it, will they come or do we need to?
I'm going to turn that over to John. I think there are certain species that we can plant. I would guess a lot of the natives like Echinacea, Monarda.
Right.
There are crops also. I think hyssop. I'll let you take that.
You mean if we plant something, will the pollinators come in?
Yeah, or the ladybugs or the praying mantises.
Well, they're going to follow where the food is, so you kind of have to think, what are they coming in for? And so for pollinators, they're going to need things to pollinate. They want pollen and nectar, so we have to have that. We also have to have places for them to carry out their lives. So for bees, for example, honeybees may be a hive, or if they're a wild population, they need a hollow tree or something nearby where they're going to have their colony. For other kinds of bees, like bumblebees and stuff, they need to have places in the ground where they construct their nests. And the ladybugs will come in if there are sources of food like aphids and things in the garden that they can go. If not, they have wings and they fly off to the next garden.
Also, we should be aware that the movement, you can now buy ladybugs. And you can buy them in our garden centers, and there's great organic mail order places. And they send them to you at least 3 to 4 times a year. So there's no reason for anybody not to be with ladybugs, and they are one of the greatest things on earth.
And what do they do? You mentioned they go after aphids.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, and white flies. Oh, a whole host of insects that really can do harm to us, to what we do in the garden.
And I wondered, too, about other insects that can harm our garden. And we should say that there are insects that can do real damage to the crop world. But besides aphids, you know, who's on the sort of wanted list?
Well, I'd say certainly slugs. And I guess would you consider those insects?
No,
or no?
They're not insects.
Okay,
they're bad guys.
And of course, the black beetles on our roses. And I think that people really get so hyped up. I guess my message, why I'm interested in participating today, is to tell our public, all of us gardeners, calm down, observe, take your time. This is not World War III. We live on the earth with other living things, and we should have respect for them.
So you're saying we're just much too quick. We see a bug. We don't know what it is. We get out the
panic
zapper.
Hits. Pandemonium. Annihilation. Got to fix it. It's very much the way we treat medicine in the Western world versus the Eastern take. It's not incorporated internally into our cultural values. And I think, unfortunately, we're really doing tremendous harm. It saddens me how much harm we're doing to our world, and it's not necessary.
Well, I'm thinking, too, you begin to see signs now that you know, of lawns that are chemically sprayed.
Right.
The signs are basically keep off. What bug, what insect is going to survive that kind of carpet spraying?
Well, yes, and they're killing off the beneficial insects and doing harm. We were talking pre the show, and I was saying in the neighborhood I live in that I think about 98% of the people are using Chemlawn. And I'm appalled. And people know that. I think they laugh. People come to my garden. But I'm one of the few gardens that has a grass with dandelions in it.
And the world did not come to an end, did it?
I don't know how you were raised.
Yeah.
But I was raised, although my father had us down on, you know, on our fours picking the dandelions. What's going on?
Right. Well, I mean, does this concern you, John?
Well, it does concern me. I think people need, when they're going to spray, they need to look at the warnings on the back of the can and think, is this important enough that I want to put this out there? In my yard, I think, you know, my economic life does not depend on what I'm growing in my yard. I want to have, say, tomatoes or whatever. But, you know, I always take that into account. Now, a farmer has to view that differently. But now there's a lot more products out there for a farmer to pursue biological controls, for example, that won't have those broad effects. I think basically you want to use something that is as best targeted to that pest, but you also want to make sure that that pest is really truly a pest that you need to get rid of, because you may see it, but it may not be causing really enough damage that it's ever going to be a problem for you.
Well, that means we have to know the bug world so we can identify so-called friends and foes.
Correct.
But, Fran, are you saying then, and using the ladybug as an example, that in the world of insects, there are, you know, predators and preys. It's a matter of sort of figuring out that relationship and who might sort of do the dirty work for us.
Yes. And I think it's important because very few of us, including myself, have expertise in the area. I think what we live in such a horticulturally rich area, the Delaware Valley, not to take advantage of all the avenues we have, just PHS, all the extension centers, I think Penn State has it. There is no reason in the world that I can imagine on the internet. I mean, I got information off the internet. There's no reason for any of us to move forward without knowing what we're doing. And again, the other piece is there are so many old-fashioned remedies that if you are unsure and you're somewhat compulsive and you say, I just don't have the patience, well, get out there with horticultural oil or neem oil or baking soda mixed with water. There's a lot of good that can be done with non-toxic home remedies.
Don't run for that toxic spray. Mm-hmm. Use oils and things like that. Also, certain bugs you can pick right off.
Oh, sure. The beetles on your roses, which can cause tremendous damage. You can use soap and water. You can use neem oil. But very often what I'll do, I'll just take an old coffee can and fill it with soapy water. And if I'm really vicious, I hate to tell you. I love to see them sizzle. And you just, you know, pick them off and say, bye, guys. What can I say? So, yes, there are ways. And there's wonderful organic mail order places. And I don't know if I'm allowed to. But something like, and people just aren't aware, www.gardensalive.com. Mm-hmm. They have everything there that you could possibly imagine that you might need, and they specifically tell you what to use for what circumstance.
And I'm thinking too, Fran, that there are plants. I know there's a butterfly bush that is attractive to butterflies. Other plants that can bring the butterflies
sure.
back here?
Any of the natural ones like Monarda, Rudbeckia, Echinacea, the list goes on and on. Perovskia, lots of herbs, plants that fall under herbs, and lots of vines also. That red vine, I think it's the cardinal flower vine. Mm. You can buy them, the annuals. You can get them anywhere. Any of the home improvement centers, go out and buy those annual seeds. Sunflowers are great to bring into the garden. So we're not talking about a lot of space or a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Anybody can participate in this.
Right.
Dill, fennel. I mean, there's tons of stuff. So just get out and explore. And my philosophy always is do it. Experiment. Have fun. You be the scientist. Don't let the experts dictate to you what you should be doing. Let your heart lead the way. Let your intuition lead the way. And then go with it. And you're going to learn by doing. And that's the fun. Enjoy the process.
I'm ready.
Let's go, guys. Let's get in the garden.
That was my 2001 conversation with gardener Fran Soren and entomologist John Gelhaus. When we get back from the break, we'll hear about the musicality of bugs and get some examples of their musical abilities. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Insect Appreciation Hour of Radio Times in Review. We just heard all about the good that bugs provide the natural world, but what about the aesthetic pleasure they bring, the soundtrack they provide on a quiet night sitting on the porch, relaxing to the hum of their collective sounds?
This musicality did not go unnoticed by composer, author, and philosopher naturalist David Rothenberg. He explored nature's musicians in a number of capacities, including in birds and in whales, and has incorporated these sounds into his compositions. When he joined us on Radio Times a few years ago, he had just published his book, Bug Music, How Insects Gave Us Rhythm and Noise. Let's take a listen. You call cicadas the oldest musicians.
Insects in general, yeah. Because they've been around millions of years before all these other creatures like us have evolved, and they're making these sounds that are essential to their way of life. And I think these sounds are closer to music than to language, because they are the same things done over and over and over and over again. Like in music, you know, we don't get bored of regular beats. We like it. We like the repetition. We need to hear it again and again. Familiar songs that we like, you know, that people get kind of addicted to, we listen to over and over and over and over again. And we don't say, oh, I already heard that. I already got the news. You know, I think in the animal world, there's a lot of communication that works like that.
Do you think in some subliminal way that the insect world has helped us develop our own rhythm patterns, for instance?
I think it's quite likely. I don't have any proof of that. It's hard to prove prehistoric things like that. But, you know, you listen to the rhythms of insects, and you imagine these are kind of rhythms that have been around for millions of years. So as humans started making music, these are sounds that we heard around us, and particularly the rhythms you hear around this time of year, katydids and crickets at night, this kind of thrumming noise that you know, it seems organized. There's some order to it. There's some patterns you hear, and the whole science of how these patterns happen, even though every individual insect is not thinking too much about the whole, is really a kind of model of how people can make music, only knowing their own particular part and it all fitting together, because everyone only knows some very simple rules. The music kind of emerges.
I want to read a poem that you include in this book, and this is a poem. It goes back, to 658. It's a Chinese prisoner. It's titled "A Political Prisoner Listens to a Cicada," and the poem goes like this: "While the year sinks westward, I hear a cicada bid me to be resolute here in my cell. Yet it needed the song of those black wings to break a white-haired prisoner's heart. His flight is heavy through fog. His pure voice drowns in the windy world. Who knows if he'll be singing still? Who listens anymore to me?" That is a beautiful poem. I mean, it's a heartbreakingly beautiful poem, I have to say.
Yes, and I was very amazed to find it, because there's a whole story in the book that I go into in which I was really interested in what it might mean to experience being underground 17 years or 13 years and then emerge. And I decided to tie in the story of a friend of mine, Timothy Blunk, who was in prison for 13 years, to this whole cicada story. I took Tim down to listen to cicadas, to Virginia, and to make music with them, and to kind of reflect on, you know, his suffering being stuck in jail all that time and emerging with this natural phenomenon. At the same time, I said, like, I don't know if this is a good idea, because I'm kind of trivializing your story of suffering and the punishment you went through with this thing in the natural world. But he says, oh, let's do it. You know, nobody wants to talk to me about this. No one really wants to talk about what it's really like to be in prison. Let's connect it to nature. And it turned out we made a whole film about this that's going to come out soon. And, you know, it was a really interesting part of the story. And I felt it was really worthwhile and worth doing. And then I also was very fortunate to come across these many volumes of poems about singing insects that an entomologist in Canada had just collected in his spare time, a man named Keith Kevin. You know, and they were just sitting in the basement of an insect museum in Montreal. And I said, I need these books. And there's five of them. They're, each one is like 600 pages in length. And so I was pouring through these. And there were so many poems, most of them from Asia, about cicadas, about crickets. And I came across this prisoner poem. And I thought, that's it. You know, I'm not the only one to try and make this connection.
Yeah. And we're almost up on a break here. But a kind of a companionship with this gigantic insect world.
People for thousands of years have tried to define themselves in connection with the nature around. And particularly in Asia, I think insects are taken seriously in a different way. The insects are considered very beautiful, very romantic, and very close to important emotions in human life. And that's why there's so much more written about them in that part of the world, China and Japan.
And David, I'd like to play and have you actually set up for us. This is an excerpt from the CD. It's titled Insect Drummers 2, The Water Boatman's Loudest Penis. And I think before we hear this, we need to know what we're talking about. Go ahead.
You know, usually in many cases, most of the time, the bigger the animal, the louder the sound it can make. So elephants make a lot of noise. Large whales make these low songs as loud as rock concerts. And usually the small creatures are quieter, except there's one big blip in this list. So there's a tiny insect that lives underwater in the British Isles called the lesser water boatman. And it's like less than half a centimeter in length or so, a quarter inch in length. And this guy makes this huge sound underwater. It's so loud that when scientists stuck underwater microphones in a marsh in England and heard it, they said, where's the giant motorboat here? I don't see anything. What's wrong with our equipment? And it turns out this water bug is vibrating his penis back and forth at astonishing speed and making a huge amount of noise. And so this story, which, you know, as you might imagine, has been widely reported, you know, online and in the news and on radio, and it was discovered by a guy named James Windmill, which is a great name.
It sure is.
And so I decided that, you know, in my further exploration beyond cicadas and crickets and katydids into the sounds of the insect world, really had to deal with this creature and its sound. And there are three pieces on the record, each called Insect Drummers 1, 2, and 3. And I have to say, unlike the first track we heard, this is not made out of exactly the sound of this guy, although it sounds quite like it. It's based electronically around the idea and the kind of aesthetic of the way these creatures make sound. And I was kind of playing with that idea that what kind of music do you make when you spend like a few years just listening to all these bug sounds and changing one's idea of what can count as music? How does this change what kind of sound you think can be musical? So unlike the first piece, which was recorded live in a forest, this one is made in the studio around the reconstruction of the sound of the lesser water boatman, one of the world's smallest, loudest bugs, and his, magnificent, penis vibrating dance underwater with this kind of crazy sound that nobody could believe could come from so small a creature when it was discovered just a few years ago.
Well, we are all ears. Let's listen. That's an excerpt from Insect Drummers 2, The Water Boatman's Loudest Penis. We are talking with David Rothenberg. And again, another fascinating piece of music. And what else besides the waterman's penis, what else are we hearing in that?
Oh, there you have a clarinet and you have the guitar of Robert Jurjendal, who's an Estonian musician I often play along with. And we hear a kind of synthesizer sound on a computer made to sort of emulate kinds of sounds that water boatmen and other underwater beetles make. You know, if you drop an underwater microphone into ponds and marshes, you can sometimes hear these very strange sounds that a human ear couldn't otherwise pick up because they're underwater. And sound strangely travels faster and more efficiently in water than in air. Mm-hmm. So these sounds can be very far away and they kind of all merge together into this strange, thrumming, noisy mix.
You have a caution for this song. Do not try this at home.
Yeah, you shouldn't. We cannot so easily make music with the same anatomy as these creatures do. But, you know, I mean, I'm sure people have tried everything, so no matter how much you warn them, nothing is enough. Yeah, you know.
But, you know, it's so interesting, the more you listen to these insects, and that you can hear computers, you can hear electronic music. I mean, the world that we live in now, even beyond what the insects are doing, in many ways mimics the insect world.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, while making this record, I thought, like, this is really strange. There's some very strange sounds here. Nobody is going to get it. No one's going to like it. They're going to think this is just completely crazy. But I didn't realize how much like pop music a lot of this sounds. Like, you listen to the kinds of sounds that are in pop music now, kind of strange electronic whooshing dubstep kind of noises, things that my 14-year-old son listens to. It's a lot like this, you know. So it's much more current than I thought it was. But it's no surprise because, you know, I mean, I'm hearing all those things too.
Sure.
So I didn't realize that, like, maybe it's not as unusual as I thought. Maybe it's really of the time, these kinds of sounds. And but it's important for someone to say, look, it all comes from bugs. Come on, take them more seriously.
And is that part of your message here? Take them more seriously?
Absolutely. Take the sounds of the natural world seriously. We'll take nature more seriously. We won't destroy it so wantonly and imagine we are superior and our music is superior. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's really true. If you read this book, if you listen to this stuff, if you then listen outside at night, you hear a lot more. It works. You know, I was shocked. It really does work on people. And many people have told me that it's really changing how they hear the world around them. It's changing their ideas about noise. What is noise and what is music?
And what is noise? What is music? Do you make a big demarcation there?
Well, I don't try and over-define these terms that people are using different ways. I mean, the noise is basically sound that you don't like. If you hear some music you don't like, you say, this is noise. If it's bothering you, it's noise. And it's music if you decide it's worth listening to. Not just in itself, because we don't just listen to music and not focus on anything else. The sounds of people in general like the sounds of a summer night, and they see it as a kind of background music to a certain season of the year. It's easy for people to appreciate that. And not everyone appreciates cicadas and their kind of thrumming, loud, sort of sometimes menacing sounds. But if you think about them more, if you study them, if you visualize them, print them out as these kinds of sonogram diagrams that scientists use, you see how rich and complicated and beautiful they really are.
Well, in fact, you include some of those sonograms in your book, and one can visually see exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I do want to play another selection from the CD for your book. This is Insect Drummers 3, Your Sound Can Kill. But tell us first about this guy named David Dunn.
Well, David Dunn is a remarkable character. He's a composer and sort of philosopher of music in a way, an inventor of very strange kind of microphones that can hear places we otherwise couldn't hear. And he figured out how to turn a meat thermometer into a microphone that could listen inside of trees. And he did this because he knew that, you know, in Santa Fe where he lives, on a whole part of the country, pine bark beetles were decimating the forests. Hundreds of thousands of acres of forest were being destroyed by these beetles that were just chewing everything to death. And they had never appeared in such great numbers. And we're not sure why. It's possibly because it's getting warmer and they don't get killed in the winter time. And so he wondered what's going on inside the trees. And when he listened, he found that they had a huge amount of acoustic communication that no one imagined. These little tiny beetles, they're maybe 1/4 the size of a lesser water boatman. They're only like, you know, 1 or 2 millimeters in length. And they're kind of talking to each other, making all these crazy little sounds that sound very alien. And he started then playing strange sounds to them. He started playing the sounds of other species, the sounds of people talking. And then he found you could actually confuse them and make them sort of turn cannibalistic and start eating each other if you played them very strange sounds. And until he did this, no scientist knew that they made sound, these beetles. Because, you know, a lot of the natural world, we just don't know how to tune into their senses without sort of figuring out what those senses might be. So no one had thought that beetles inside of trees use sound in any way. And so he started experimenting with this. And so this piece, again, is one of the ones electronically synthesized out of the kinds of sound these beetles make, and the whole story about, you know, how, you know, on the one hand, these beetles are incredibly destructive, and they're kind of talking to each other about something, planning the killing all the forests, who knows. And then also you can use sound to kill them. So it's kind of playing on those ideas.
Well, let's listen. And that's an excerpt from Insect Drummer's Three, Your Sound Can Kill. It does raise an intriguing question about, you know, whether you could use sound, in a sense, to save a forest from these destructive beetles.
You know, practically it would be impossible because to broadcast the sound into the trees is hard enough. And then you've got millions of trees. So if you're broadcasting inside every tree to reach these beetles, you know, that would be completely impractical. You can use sound to like scare woodchucks away, but that's just like from your garden. But to communicate sonically, I don't know, maybe there'd be some way to make the whole earth rumble with a sound they wouldn't like. But the fact is we have no idea how to deal with these creatures. And we don't know that much about them. But it's also possible that more acoustic study of what they're doing might lead us to learn more about what makes them proliferate. And, you know, we could very well discover some surprising thing through that research that would enable us to affect this vast amount of devastation these bugs are making. Most of the insects, by the way, that make it into this book and this story are not particularly destructive or sinister, even though in general people are often afraid of bugs and they think that they're dangerous. They think cicadas are like locusts. They're going to descend and destroy all the crops. They don't really do that much damage when they appear. And that, and yet people are somehow predisposed to fear insects sometimes, it seems, even though they're probably among the more benign and necessary parts of the environment.
That was my 2013 conversation with musician and philosopher David Rothenberg, author of Bug Music. When we get back from the break, try to make it through our conversation about the tastiness of bugs. Stay with us. Welcome back to the bug-friendly edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks again for joining us today. Would you eat a bug? Some of us can barely stand the sight of them, but bugs are nutrient-rich. They can be cooked and devoured just like any other protein. On top of that, if we could get over the gross-out factor, eating bugs could help solve the world's hunger crisis. We talked about all of this when we were joined by Daniela Martin, author of Edible, An Adventure into the World of Eating Insects. Also with us was Paul Rosin, a University of Pennsylvania professor of psychology who also happens to be an expert in disgust. Let's take a listen. I watched a video of you yesterday cooking and deep frying a breaded scorpion. You were careful not to eat the poisonous tail, and I saw you chewing on it, a kind of a crunchy meal. What did it taste like?
To me, it tastes a great deal, like a very light, earthy lobster. You do have to get through the shell.
Yes.
But I think that a good comparison to keep in mind is that lobsters are bottom feeders. They're scavengers. They're eating the dead bodies of other fish. They're eating, you know, fish feces. Whereas a scorpion eats all of its prey live. So, I think that's important to keep in mind.
Well, I have to say that as I looked at it, and I'm not particularly squeamish about bugs, but as I looked at that video of you, Daniela, I did sort of grimace. Did you have to get over that for yourself?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was terrified. In fact, shortly before shooting that video, I read online that certain species of scorpion can go into the deep freeze for up to a couple of weeks, come out, thaw, and reanimate.
Oh, Lordy.
So, yeah, I was nervous. Let's put it that way.
Let me get Paul Rosin in on the conversation. And we've had you on the show before talking about taste preferences and things like disgust. What is that yuck factor about?
It's a universal reaction to probably in its core animal products. Almost everything that people call disgusting cross-culturally is an animal product. And the issue with insects is interesting because they're the rule, not the exception. If you think of Americans, we eat the muscle of pig, cow, and lamb sometimes. There are over 4,000 species of animals. We find all the rest of them disgusting.
Right.
We find all the reptiles, all the amphibians, many fish, all the invertebrates with a few exceptions like clams and octopus. So we're basically disgusted by almost every animal, and insects are in that category. So the issue is, why do we suspend disgust when we eat beef or pork? And one reason we do is that we're not thinking of a cow when we eat beef.
We're thinking of this piece of something, this slab of something that's in front of us.
Yeah, and a lot of people go to some effort, and so does the marketing, the food marketers. For example, a little child, 4-year-old, goes to the meat section. They would have no idea that a piece of red stuff with a little white on, fat on it is a piece of a cow.
But if we have a scorpion in our hand, as Daniela had, there's no getting around the fact that we're about to eat a bug.
Well, there is a way to get around it, and that's to use insect flour, which in terms of human acceptance is much more effective. It's just like other flour. It's better protein content, and you could put it in things instead of wheat. The problem with it is it doesn't replace meat as an experience. It replaces meat as a nutritive substance.
And Danielle, you talk about flour. I mean, the various ways that insects can be, I guess, ground up and put into other food or used as a kind of a food substitute. Can you expand on that?
Certainly. This again is a very old idea. This is something that has been going on since early Native American life here in the U.S. One of the very first versions of an energy bar, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, is something called pemmican, which is basically crushed meat or, in certain cases, ground insects with things like berries and nuts. And this was something that they would use as kind of a trek food when they were out hunting or traveling. This is something they would eat along the way. So it's kind of the early version of a power bar. Interestingly, in areas that – so this was something that was very typical in a place like Utah. Today in Utah, there is a company called Chapul, which is using essentially this very same technology to make insect flour protein bars.
You know, I'm looking at a table here where you compare the protein and the fat, the calcium, the B12, things like crickets and mealworms and waxworms, comparing it to beef and fish, salmon, for instance, chicken even. And protein-wise, a mealworm, you know, beats out chicken and beats out salmon.
It's pretty impressive, actually. Several of the farmed insects, you know, basically a handful of species that are typically farmed in today's world. There's about, you know, a handful of species that are farmed in today's world. There's crickets, waxworms, mealworms, and a couple of other less popular varieties. The idea is that these insects are typically so much higher in the types of nutrients that we typically turn to meat for, things like B12, zinc, calcium, iron, and even protein, that it's kind of like those old Total commercials. You have to eat this many bowls of the competition cereal to equal this many bowls of Total. It's the same thing with insects.
Well, I think it's absolutely perfect that you feel like barfing as we're talking about eating insects. And we have a world authority on disgust who's across from me here, Paul Rosin. I mean, I think you can put maybe a cricket in one category and perhaps sort of a wormy kind of creature in another category. Do we have different responses like that?
There are certainly different degrees of disgust, and generally gooey, wet things like a worm, because people think of a mealworm as a worm, not as an insect,
right,
or a caterpillar. So people love butterflies, but they don't like caterpillars, which are, of course, pre-butterflies. So generally speaking, if you're thinking of eating a whole insect, something like a cricket, which is crispy and doesn't have the sense of having goo in it, would be more acceptable. I think there are two general approaches to this problem. One is taken by the Nordic Lab, which is related to the famous restaurant Noma in Copenhagen, and they are trying to make insects delicious. Mm. They take pupa of bees and they make ceviche and do sorts of things to try to make it, integrate it into fine food, and some of the top restaurants like Noma serve insects. The other approach is to come sneak up from the bottom, put a little bit in, which most people will take 0.1% insect flour in their chocolate chip cookies.
Right.
You know, you won't taste anything.
Right.
And by the way, insects taste rather mild. So there's two approaches, and the issue really is whether you're focusing on the developing world, where there's a real shortage of protein and nutrient, for which insects are a really important solution, where you could certainly put them in the flour. And our world, where we treat them more like sushi, you know, they're sort of a trendy food. Now, sushi has become extremely successful in the United States.
Yes.
It's the 10th most popular food, and it is raw fish. It is disgusting, but people have overcome that. So it's a model for what you might be able to do with insects.
But is that just good marketing, or if you actually try it, it actually tastes good? I mean, that you sort of over time introduce yourself to foods that you might not want to...
Yeah, there are things that, like chocolate, if someone is reluctant to eat it, if you can get it in their mouth, you win, because it tastes so good. Now, with insects, you've got the problem that the idea of eating them is bad, so that people might not like the taste of cricket, but if they didn't know it was a cricket, they might like the taste.
Right.
So you have to get by that too. But things like crickets are very nice snacks. They're crispy. They're eaten as snacks in a lot of in Southeast Asia and other places. So they're pretty appealing. They're like potato chips in a way, you know.
Well, it sounds like you've eaten them.
Yes.
And enjoyed that.
Yes.
Daniel, let me go back to you. And you were really introduced to eating bugs when you were living in Mexico, right?
That's right. For my undergraduate degree in anthropology, I was studying pre-Columbian nutrition. What I wanted to see was what vestiges of early native cuisine had survived to the present day, what things the early Aztecs and Maya had been eating that they were still eating today. And one of those vestiges that they ate, you know, hundreds of years ago and that they still eat today is insects.
Mm. And what was your first meal, so to speak?
The first time I got to taste them, I was in Oaxaca. There was a woman by the side of the road selling chapulines, which is a kind of a toasted chili lime grasshopper. And I bought a little bag of them, and I went to sit down at a cafe because I knew I was going to need something to wash that down with. And I poured my little bag of bright red grasshoppers out onto my tablecloth to take a picture. And the next thing I knew, I was surrounded by native Trique indigenous kids off of the street who'd come in to eat my grasshoppers right off my table. And as a young anthropology student, to have that moment of cultural immersion, you know, plus I love kids, it was incredibly inspirational. And from that moment on, I've just been fascinated by the topic.
And did you love the grasshoppers?
You know, I didn't. My first taste, I think, was a bit biased, and they tasted kind of like a sour potato chip. Wasn't my favorite. But the next time that I cooked bugs, I cooked them myself with my own recipe, and that time I liked them a lot.
And what goes well with grasshopper?
A
nice light white wine or something like that?
Yeah. Well, actually, I think beer goes extremely well with most bugs, because the flavors of insects are typically nutty, maybe a little shrimpy, kind of mushroomy, very earthy flavors. So I think these pair exceptionally well with beer. I think insects in that kind of family go very well with garlic.
I would say that was true. By the way, my first experience with insects was also in Oaxaca, as it happens. Uh-huh. I was working in a little village trying to understand how children got to like chili pepper. And I was living in the village, and I had, I was eating what they ate as long as it was cooked, and I had some grubs. I don't know what the source was, but in a typical Mexican preparation with tomatoes and chili pepper, it was very good. But I mean, it was more the whole flavor that was good. And I also had some grasshoppers there, and that was my. So we've had Danielle
Similar.
And I have had this first same experience in the same location. So I just wanted to mention another thing about this. There's an ethical issue here. There's an environmental ethical issue that many people feel that, you know, the environment is a moral responsibility, and insects are clearly better for the environment than normal meat. But in addition, killing. A lot of people are upset about killing cows and pigs. Some of them become vegetarians, but many of them remain omnivores. Like me, I'm an omnivore, but I don't like the idea that I'm eating a killed pig. And I don't mind raising crickets and eating them. The ethical issue seems to be less potent. And there's really a lot of this. A lot of people who are not comfortable eating meat, though they eat it.
But is that because crickets don't have fur? I mean, is it sort of we have an affiliation with pigs and cows and chickens?
Yeah, we can see them. We can feel them, that they feel pain. We don't think of insects in the same way. It's a question whether insects feel pain, of course. But also you can raise insects very efficiently, giving them a pretty natural environment. A free-range grasshopper doesn't take a lot of space up, whereas a free-range cow does. So the ethical issues of raising insects are much weaker than the ethical issues for animals.
Daniel, let me pick up on that, because it's clear that you love insects. I mean, I've been watching some of your videos and certainly reading your book and some of your blog as well. So do you feel by eating something that you love that there's some moral ethical issue for you?
No.
Okay, fair enough. Just checking.
I do love insects, and the more I eat them, the more I appreciate and respect them. I definitely want to agree with what Paul was just saying. Some of the ethical issues, I think, are lessened because insects have really short lifespans. A cricket, for instance, lives 3 to 4 months and spends most of that time either growing or reproducing. Mm. Whereas cows can live, you know, I think probably at least a decade.
How you doing up there? How you doing over there in Minnesota?
I'm holding up. I think I'm in a very unique position of someone who's already quite nauseous and has to talk in detail about eating bugs.
But that's not, this is your fate in life, though, Danielle.
That's not a problem for you, Danielle, because for you, they're not nauseating, right? It's just your audience.
Well, right. You know, this is the first time. You know, I've heard people say, oh, eating bugs is gross. Right, I'm sure, Paul, you're all over this. This is your whole thing. And this is a fairly typical, if typically untested, opinion of eating bugs. And I had never been able to relate to it before because I'm open-minded and I think I'm fairly logical about what I put in my mouth. And it's the first time in my life that I can finally go, yep, that does seem a little gross. So I'm pretty sure it'll just be temporary.
Can I quote something else from your book, Daniela? And this is something you write saying, it's a simple fact that many of the bugs we hate the most are the ones that eat what we eat, the ones that perhaps even compete with us for food. I thought that was an interesting comment.
Well, I spent a good deal of time when writing this book trying to divine what caused the big bug breakup. I mean, this is something that we have always eaten throughout human evolution. There's virtually never been a time when people weren't eating bugs. And that includes modern day America. We're still eating bugs, except they're just ground up in our food supply, so we're not aware of it. And so one of the avenues I kind of went down was, well, perhaps, you know, when we started being involved in agriculture. Excuse me.
Oh, my God.
This is the first, Danielle.
Go ahead. Soldier on.
I'll soldier on. when the agricultural revolution started, that may have been a point when insects ceased to be seen as part of the protein that we ate every day and as an enemy to the crops we were trying to grow. So that's definitely a possibility. And different cultures have dealt with it in different ways. There are some places like Thailand and certain countries in Africa where the pests that feed on the crop fetch a higher market price than the crop itself.
I wanted to comment on the quote you cited, because the quintessential disgusting insect in this country is probably the cockroach. And I think what Daniela was referring to there is that cockroaches are like humans. They eat everything. Wherever you find the human, you'll find the cockroach. I mean, because we both manage to find something to eat. So we should admire them in a way, but we don't.
That was my 2014 conversation with University of Pennsylvania psychologist and disgust expert Paul Rosin and Daniela Martin, author of a book called Edible, about growing up and eating bugs. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits the show. I'm Marty Moskowing. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.